You are listening to the second of a two-part post-GDC Brainy Gamer podcast. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you'll listen to part one as well. You can find it on my website or on iTunes. Enjoy. I am happy to introduce three more guests for this edition of the Gamers Confab post-GDC edition. My guests in this segment are David Carlton, author of the Malvasia Bianca blog and a man with wide-ranging interests, video games being only one of them. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Glad to have you back on the show again. We have a first-time visitor to the Gamers Confab, Mr. Nels Anderson, who is a designer at Hothead Games. He also writes a blog called Above 49, which is terrific. I'll have a link for that as well in the show notes. And I got to meet Nels finally at GDC and was happy to do that. Welcome, Nels.
Thank you, Michael. It was very nice to meet you finally in person as well.
Yeah, well, that's sort of like half the thing about GDC, isn't it?
It seemed to be.
Yeah. And finally, I guess my most frequent guest, most appearances on the Gamers Confab record is held by Ms. Lee Alexander. She's the news director at Gamasutra. She also writes a monthly column for Kotaku. And, of course, she's the author of the Sexy Video Game Land blog. And Lee, always great to have you on the show.
Of course, I come on so often because you introduce me so well. Thank you.
Hey, you know, I actually, you've changed here and there and you have different responsibilities. So actually, I think
I do, but you've managed to keep track of it the whole time.
But you get a different intro each time, which is sort of cool.
I know, kind of funny.
Well, I, in sort of typical teacher fashion, I guess I, asked people to go have this GDC field trip. And then when they came back, they had to write a report on what they learned. And so that's what we're doing. And we've done this in each of the segments. And I have with these three guests, I think an interesting combination. I thought this particular segment would be useful because we're really coming at GDC from very different directions. And I thought, you know, in a certain way, it might be fun to start with you, Nels, because you seem, in my mind anyway, to be sort of the absolute target audience for GDC in terms of its like original configuration. You're a young designer, probably, you know, thinking a lot about design issues and also, you know, trying to meet people and get to know people in the industry. And there you were at was this your first GDC?
It was. And just as a slight correction, just to be totally accurate, my role is technically a gameplay programmer, That means a lot of design work. It's not, you know, super distance like shaders and renderers or anything like that. It's all real concrete gameplay stuff.
Okay, cool.
But just so I'm not misrepresented myself.
Well, that's actually very helpful. And I think, you know, one of the things about going to GDC is you start to learn the kind of the gradations of, you know, how people work in the industry. And, you know, there really are kind of fine distinctions that I think most people who just play games, even serious gamers, may not quite understand how all those work.
Yeah, that's true.
It's challenging enough already, too. It depends on the company, doesn't it? You know, what a title means from one to another could be different.
Oh, yeah. Like, there's tremendous variance. Like, someone will introduce themselves, give their title, and you really don't know that much about what they actually do. Because some places being a producer means you're, like, half a designer. And other places it means you're, like, a project manager that doesn't ever really get involved with the nuts and bolts of the game. It's sort of interesting and kind of crazy how that's just sort of how the industry works.
Well, I'm curious from your point of view, having gone this time for your first attendance at the event, was there a session or an experience that you had this year that sort of stuck out in your mind as particularly useful or meaningful to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Probably the single one I enjoyed most, I almost didn't go to, but Wes Iroquois Pliskin was going and he convinced me to go along with him. Randy Smith gave a talk about using human-computer interaction principles, specifically the principles laid out in the book The Design of Everyday Things, which I wrote about and absolutely love. So he used that to sort of inform how to make better puzzles that are more interesting, more solvable. And I just thought that there's sort of been this growing trend of focusing on usability and playtesting in industry to sort of make games more readable, more understandable. And his talk just sort of consolidated all of those things, and it was really, really, really enjoyable.
What is it about that book? I know Wes mentioned it when we spoke yesterday. What is it about that book that makes people make the video game connection so frequently? Because I hear about that book a lot.
Yeah, it was sort of this one of the seminal treatises that kind of launched modern understanding of computer interaction and usability and all that kind of stuff. But it's totally framed in just interacting with everyday objects, which I think makes it really, really understandable and slightly frustrating in that as soon as you read that book, you will realize that almost every door in the universe is poorly designed and it makes you angry entering buildings.
Yeah, I was just pushing on a door with a vertical handle the other day. And
exactly.
Yeah.
So is there a practical application? I mean, do you find yourself going back home thinking, you know, here are the three things I need to start thinking about or doing differently in my work?
I don't think I could distill it down to bullet points. It would be awesome if I could. I could just present it to everybody else at work and say, we should do X, Y, and Z, and things would be great. But I did try to think a lot about, because the game we're working on right now has been described, it's Deathbank. It's Ron Gilbert's new game, and it's been described as halfway between Diablo and Monkey Island.
Can you give the title of the game again?
Death Spank.
Okay, good.
Yes,
I just like hearing you say
title.
It.
Yeah. Now, one more time, we didn't catch that real slowly now with articulation.
Death Spank.
Aw, yeah.
I'll see if I can add some reverb on the post on this. So
awesome.
Even better.
Yeah, but Ron was very, very emphatic that is what the game will be called. It is its fundamental essence, and I don't disagree with that. So it's like it will have this sort of adventure game puzzly, you know, that will be a large component of the game, and trying to figure out how to do that in ways that aren't frustrating, that don't make the player feel, you know, stupid when they can't solve it or things like that is tough, because it probably was pretty evidenced when people played through Grim Fandango. Those old adventure games can be really frustrating.
In a good way, though. I think that's part of the charm.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe I'm just...
Don't get me wrong. Like, I love those games. Like,
you know
those
how much money I
things.
Spent on the Sierra line when I was a little girl?
Yeah, I know. Me too, although I wasn't a little girl. But, yeah. Exactly. David, you and I were involved in the playthrough of Grim Fandango for the Vintage Game Club, and
it was
a pretty interesting playthrough. I mean, with a group of people kind of encountering that degree of difficulty or that particular construction for a game design that I think younger people just had never seen.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it, and I grew up playing Infocom games, so I should be able to do that stuff, but I had to go back to GameFAQs at least once every level in that game. So,
yeah.
And the frustrating thing, too, was once you go to GameFAQs once, it's kind of hard to stop. It's
slippery slope. It definitely
is.
Yeah.
It's like beating you down, you know, flipped a switch in your brain or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I definitely appreciate things that Randy Smith had to say about helping players solve problems, but not in a way that made them feel as if you'd sort of embedded GameFAQs in the game and were treating them like an idiot.
Yeah.
That's right. You were in that session, too.
Yeah.
Did you sort of find it equally interesting and delicious?
Yeah, it was totally delightful. I'd never really thought, like, one of the things that I thought was interesting was in his discussion in how players can go wrong, there's two sort of different ways in which a player can go wrong. One of them is that they just have no idea what to do. So they're poking around the environment and they don't even, you know, they're not aware something's a switch or something like that. And so if you do that, you want to, if you see that happening in playtests, then you want to, you know, give visual cues or something like that to make it clear that certain areas in the environment are the important ones. So you want to have people focus more on the important ones. And then the other way in which people can go wrong is if they do have a plan for what they're doing, it's a plan that doesn't work in the game. So, you know, you think, oh, if I hit this switch and then run really quickly over there, I'll be able to get under the door before it slides down, kind of thing. And you know, if you don't get there or before the door slides down, you don't know if you just didn't run fast enough or take a good enough path, or if that's just not what you can do. And so if people have an affirmative idea of what to do, it's just an idea that doesn't work in the game, then what the game designer should do is concentrate on giving explicit negative feedback rather than affirmative cues. So I thought that was a really interesting distinction.
Yeah.
Well, Nels, I went to a session that had some bearing on this from a, I guess what you call a game studies point of view. It was Ian Bogost and a couple of other sort of academics focusing on some studies that were published this year that they felt were very directly applicable to game design. They weren't overly theoretical, but they were more, you know, really practical. And one of them had to do with this kind of elusive sweet spot between, and it was a study of how gamers get connected to a game and find pleasure in it, and particularly mm-hmm. puzzle sorts of games. And essentially their point is there's this really interesting but hard to find sweet spot. If the game's too easy, players hate it. If it's too hard, they hate it. And somewhere in the middle, if the player feels challenged and fails, and that failure, this is Jesper Juhl's, by the way, study. If the player fails and fails in a certain kind of meaningful way, that is a good thing, and it's a certain kind of failure. So if it drives you through the game in a way that makes you feel smart, but mm-hmm. not, but if you feel dumb too often, then you're going to stop playing it.
That's funny.
I've explained this poorly, but it's.
No, I understand what you mean. There's an ideal middle ground on the difficulty gradient that is, you know, ideal for engagement.
Exactly, and I think he didn't talk about this so much, but I'd be curious about your take on this, Nels. Some designers have an instinctive sense of this because they play games, and so when they design them, they know it feels like it should be right about here. And other designers, or maybe even scholars, are trying to like quantify it in a certain way. They're trying to analyze it and figure it out from a sort of ludology perspective. And how do you know if you're designing puzzle games, which obviously you're deeply involved in, a game that's driven by that mechanic? How do you know?
Yeah, it's tough. Randy mentioned this in his talk, where he called this the greater than 99% problem, where say you've got five puzzles in a game, and you think they're well designed to the point where like maybe 1 in 20 people won't be able to solve any individual puzzle. That seems reasonable, but then when you actually, you know, combine all those puzzles together, that if 1 in 20 people can't solve any one of them, in aggregate, about a quarter of people who play your game won't be able to finish it. So to have people actually be able to finish your game, which I think you should, I don't think making games that are all nearly unbeatable is really valid unless you're doing it super on purpose, like, you know, Ninja Gaiden or whatever, that you have to make your puzzle solvable for like, you know, 99.8% of people to be able to have almost everyone solve your game. And it's like, that's a very, when he sort of drew it out that way, I was like, huh, well, that's hard. Because you have to make puzzles that aren't, you know, simple, like David was saying, that you haven't just embedded game facts into your game. But yeah, that are engaging when you solve them, but are still solvable for nearly everyone. And that's hard. Like, obviously, this is actually another thing I focused a lot on at GDC, the importance of playtesting and, you know, data collection and heavy, heavy iteration on your designs. Yeah. So I've got a master's degree in computer science, so I'm super analytical. I love data. So I went to a bunch of talks about this, and Mike Ambender, he's at Valve, and he's actually a PhD cognitive psychologist that Valve hired just to do playtesting and analysis of their games.
Wow.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So when I saw his talk, I'm like, wow, this is really interesting. I wish I had your endless wellspring of money and time.
Yeah. And then I think the difficulty question is interesting, too, when you factor in both who is making the game and then who the audience is. Because designing a game for, quote unquote, everyone, I think that you're not ever possibly, you know, if you're going to try to make a game that's solvable by 99% of everyone, you know, then, you know, you might even be setting too broad a goal. So, you know, whereas if you focus on a target audience of a certain number of a certain, you know, play level or a certain age group or whatever, and then you're trying to, you know, get that granularity inside of a smaller target group, it probably gets a little bit easier to make things that are richer. Because one of the things that when I speak to designers a lot is that, you know, they think like designers, they don't really think like players. And so what is sensible and logical to their minds may not be to players.
Yeah. Yes. This is definitely a lesson that I saw that people repeated time and time again, is that if you spent a week with a project, you are really too close to make any meaningful statements about its difficulty, that you have to get in fresh people, ideally, you know, from your target audience, but even some people who aren't, for contrast or whatever, and then you just have to keep iterating and playtesting with people who haven't touched it. Because I've seen this, like, even not in the games industry, like, people who are too close to a project are unable to objectively evaluate it. It's just a truth. But still, way more people than should don't acknowledge that. It's like, no, it looks fine to me. It's like, that doesn't mean anything.
And then what shocks me, I don't know whether this happens at smaller studios, but especially at the big publishers, they bring in the playtesters and they have a desired result. They want a desired, you know, percentage result on the playtesting survey. And the playtest is being led and conducted by people in spending, you know, day and night in their entire lives on this project. And the playtesters will say, I don't like this, I don't understand this. And the designer says, well, the playtest is dumb, let's get different playtesters. You know, like, you know what I mean? Like, they're insulted if they get the lack of desired feedback. They say, this group just isn't understanding me. We need a group so that we can get our hantaw rate from the playtesters.
Yeah, that's crazy, right? Then you're just, you know, you're trying to find data that will fit your conclusion, and that's
exactly,
bad science.
Exactly. And then the game doesn't sell, and the designers say the audience is stupid, you know?
So this is, maybe this is a dumb question, but I have a feeling a fair number of people would be curious to know. How do these developers find playtesters? Like, where do they go, and how do they identify who would be an ideal person?
I don't, like, since we're a very small company, we don't conduct playtests on the scale that, like, Microsoft or Valve does. So we just, you know, we can just find people in the city who are interested in games, like, you know, have some level of game literacy.
Internet survey, make a bunch of people sign an NDA and have at.
Yeah.
Well, and we heard in the Iwata keynote that Miyamoto apparently just kidnaps people in the halls of Nintendo who, you know, game developers, just from secretaries or something like that, and forces them into a room to play games for a little while.
I think they do it the same way that any product does focus tests.
I just, that Miyamoto thing just has lawsuit written all over it. It just taking women into the rooms, and, you know, I don't know. That whole listening to that described was just very odd to me. I'm sure Iwata had, you know, only the best intentions trying to describe Miyamoto's methods, but there was just a certain way of his description that made me feel a little creepy.
I think he intended it. I'm pretty sure he intended the creepy factor. I think you had the photo of Miyamoto with, like, the cowboy hat and the bandana.
Yeah. Sort of leering over the woman's shoulder, watching her play the game, which was very strange.
So I actually wanted to get back to this issue of a difficulty continuum, because I thought Randy Smith said something really interesting about that in his talk. So we have this idea of puzzles as being, you know, sort of a linear, easy, hard difficulty. And if you make them too easy, people don't like it because they feel they're being treated like idiots, so they must be stupid. And if they're too hard, people also feel they're stupid because they can't solve it. And so, you know, you ask, what's the sweet spot in the middle? And what one of the things that Randy Smith said was that you can actually adapt. That's not really the most useful way of looking into this. And if you give a sort of adaptive feedback, then a puzzle can adjust to a wide range of difficulties. So the key to this is that if people fail in an attempt to solve the puzzle, what you want to do is have the failure give feedback about the world in a way that allows the player to improve their mental model of the world. And so what happens here, if you do it right, is, you know, maybe there's somebody who comes in and they just solve the puzzle right away and they feel great. They're like, oh, here's this puzzle and I solved it and I'm smart. And then you have somebody else who takes a few tries to solve the puzzle, but each time they try to solve the puzzle, they're learning more about the world and they're sort of actively constructing a model of how that portion of the world works. And so then, you know, it takes them four tries to solve the puzzle, but they still feel really smart at the end of solving the puzzle because they've, you know, actively worked to kind of act like a scientist and test hypotheses. And so it avoids this question of you know, a single amount of hints to give for players or how easy or how hard to make it because it adapts to different approaches to the puzzle.
Yeah, and I think that was part of the reason why old adventure games like Grim Fandango were so difficult is because your model of, you know, what the puzzle was and how it works was often very incomplete. So you'd be like, well, I'm trying to solve this thing, and you just wouldn't understand it. But the reason why you didn't understand it is because, you know, there was some object in some room over in a corner that was really, really tiny that you just hadn't picked up. But you have absolutely, no way of knowing when you have all the pieces to the puzzle. So you could end up, you know, totally spinning your wheels thinking, oh, I've got all, you know, I have everything. Why doesn't this work? But you're missing something. But the game never tells you that you're missing something.
Yeah, you fail and it's just a blank wall. It's like, okay, that didn't work. And you haven't learned anything from failing. You've just gotten frustrated.
Like back in the old days, you were talking about Infocom games. You know, a lot of times if you weren't succeeding, it was because you weren't working with the parser correctly and you didn't input your commands in the right way. It's like the riddle of the Sphinx. You know, you get served, but only if you ask the question in precisely the right way.
Yeah. So I had an interesting story with that, which is one of my tricks to get my parents to buy me video games when I was growing up, is that anything educational was good. So there was a cottage industry of translating video games into French. And I was learning French, so I could get French language video games when I couldn't get English language ones, which was fine sometimes. But when I was getting adventure games that were translated into French, I mean, I could speak French well enough to talk with humans, but to deal with a bad computer parser, you know, guess the vocabulary word, it really just didn't work at all. So sounded like a good, you know, scheme to get your parents to buy you games, but didn't work so well in practice.
It does seem to me, though, back in the day, you would have to go find a guy who lived down the street who was really good at this stuff. Like, you'd have to have conversations with people when you played a game like Grim Fandango, because, of course, there was no game facts, no other solutions. So you'd have to, like, identify the guru or the person who'd actually solve that. And it created this kind of interesting human contact where, you know, you would collectively be working your way through these games.
Yeah, I needed a buddy. Back when I played the granddaddy, Colossal King, I had my little gal pal and I would get together after school and hunker down in front of a ginormous PC, and we had like sheaves of notes we had taken. I mean, neither one of us could have done it alone. It was sort of like a collaborative process. Like, people talk about, you know, social gaming and stuff, but that was my first experience simply because the games were so impenetrable that they necessitated teaming up.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and that still happens. I mean, my wife and I, when we were playing Zack and Wiki, it was usually both of us in the room, and it would happen all the time that one of us could figure out what the next step was on a puzzle when the other one of us would get stuck.
Yeah. Which is like the ideal way of playing that game, I think.
Yeah, like Nels mentioned this, you know, problem with exponential decay, whereas if you stack up a bunch of puzzles, then each of them is individually 95% successful, but if you add too many, all of a sudden only half the people can, you know, make it through. But that actually works the other way, whereas if you throw multiple people at solving the puzzle, each of them individually might have a 95% chance of solving the puzzle, but if their brains work in slightly different wavelengths, then the two of them together will be able to solve it, you know, 99.5% of the time instead of 95% of the time.
Yeah, that sort of collaborative puzzle solving experience is something that a lot of, like, way more people than I thought sort of have had. Because when I was a kid, you know, back in Wyoming, I didn't have any friends that played PC games. So it was always just me banging my head against, you know, why can't I get this thing from Scab Island? So when I heard other people talk about this, I was like, oh, that probably would have made those games a little bit less frustrating. Like, I still love them. Like, I sound all down on them, but I love all those old games. But I know exactly what you guys are saying, and that's an experience that I hope, as things move forward, that a lot more people try to evoke when making these kinds of games.
Well, I'm sure that a lot of people listening to this will be thinking the same thing, but, you know, I'm pretty excited about that game you're working on. The idea that Ron Gilbert's, you know, doing something and thinking hard about video games and, you know, working with some young and interesting people, I just think, can't wait to see what happens.
We will do our best.
Well, I wanted to ask you, Lee, about your experience at GDC, and I know this was not your first time there, and you also, in a certain way, wear a number of hats when you attend a conference like this, and you also do some presenting. So maybe your response to the conference is maybe a little different.
Yeah, I guess sometimes. Last year, and in Austin, I was doing a lot more on the presenting side. I used to run the Worlds in Motion Summit. I was edit lead on it's a Gamma Sister site that is about online worlds, social media, virtual worlds, things like that. And that used to be my jam a little bit, and I ran the conference and chaired that and moderated that. But I wasn't doing any of that at all this year. I was invited to talk on the IGDA's rant panel, but aside from that, I was really just working. I was just covering things. So, you know, I'm a little bit envious. You know, I kind of didn't have the leisure to really attend things out of curiosity, as we all had assignments and stuff. But, you know, you can't really, how can you complain? You know, everything that there is to do is pretty fun and awesome. Yeah, I really didn't get a lot of time to think. I was kind of just running around from one thing to and writing while people were talking and things like that. If you ask me, like, you know, what did you do at GDC? I'm like, oh, I don't know. You know, yeah, I did. I sort of did it from the side of an industry reporter. So it's different for me.
Yeah. So do you find yourself attending certain sessions, or I know even though you're reporting on them, You take notes for the story you're writing, but do you sometimes find yourself just on a personal level thinking, wow, that's an idea I hadn't thought of, or that, you know, it alters your thinking about games in any certain way from a design point of view? It's not
absolutely
so much about journalism or anything, but just on a personal level?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because obviously, you know, I wouldn't be so passionate about my work if I didn't have a personal interest. I'm sort of one of those people who's really, really lucky in that I'm being paid to do something that I love more than anything. So, I mean, I find it personally stimulating. And as I'm writing these articles, I just, my fingers can't stop moving because I'm making all these little parallels. What I find is that the more that I do, and, you know, from the sessions that I attend and the people that I talk to and the things that I see, you know, I'm starting to sort of aggregate a macro picture of certain trends or evolutions on trends or developments on things that I saw happening here that sort of helped create a picture view for me.
Yeah. And do you have a sense of, did there seem to be a trend that kind of emerged for you looking?
Yeah, actually, I mean, and this may have a lot to do with what I'm interested in, but what I kind of observed, you know, and this is more industry analysis and less game design philosophy. But things were really interesting to me this year. One was that you can't really ignore the mobile platform anymore now that we have an iPhone. You know, even as early back as last year, I sort of overlooked mobile, you know, not because I didn't really like it, but because, you know, I'm covering video games, not mobile games. And, you know, there, you know, when you're dealing with the mobile games, everyone had the little flippy handsets and you have to deal with the carriers and blah, blah, blah. But the phone has really, really changed everything. You have basically now a telephone that can do the same exact things as Nintendo's brand new DSi can do, you know, with the exception that it has one screen and not two, and that's really about the only difference. So that, I think, is a really exciting development for portable gaming. And, you know, when people started talking about games on the iPhone, I didn't really think it was going to go anywhere until I saw the indie scene that is happening on there. And so we know from our sort of side of things that a lot of the innovation and the really cool stuff is kind of the independent space. I went to the IGF Mobiles, and when my main takeaway, and this is one of my biggest takeaways of the whole event, is that, you know, indies are really going to change things starting on the iPhone platform as well, because you have basically, again, the same features, you know, plus accelerometer, which DSi doesn't have, you know, the same features as a common piece of portable gaming hardware, you know, only it's on a phone, increases the user base or the potential base, you know, quite a lot. And the barrier to entry for development, you know, in practical terms, the cost of the SDK is lower than developing on any other platform. So that means more people can participate, that, you know, indies are going to have an even easier time getting started on the iPhone. So when I saw the awards, I walked away saying, you know, we're going to have to look at the iPhone for the really, really cool stuff from now on. I thought that was really cool. And yeah, that sort of ties into the two other trends that I observed, which is, you know, that distribution is going to become the norm sooner rather than later. And that, so basically, yeah, distribution, portable gaming, and indies are, for me, the things that I was most excited about.
I was noticing this year on the show floor where the indie games are, that it seemed like they'd moved it out to an area where, you know, they seemed more central, less sort of tucked away. But even so, it was like a nightmare getting in to see those games and getting close to them. That just the buzz around those games, but also just the plain old traffic around them. And like, I would see some fairly significant, notable faces among the people that were making their way through.
Oh yeah,
I mean, this was, everybody wanted to see those indie games this year.
Oh, I know. I think that, you know, last year, you know, everyone said it was the year of, and it's only gotten more and more true, that I think that people now see that winning the IGF is kind of, is a big deal, not only for the developer and that they're probably going to get their game commercially made in a big way, but that it's a big deal for the game industry because, you know, whatever's coming out of the festival is going to be bringing something very fresh and new to the table, you know, to sort of, you know, in order to attract that attention and sort of be heard amongst so many people that want to be doing that, there has to be, you know, something very fresh and very unique. And I would even say revolutionary about things that are coming out of the indie space. I think that everyone wants to be the one to spot the next big thing, both fans and people who have a business interest. You know, everyone wants to be the first one to grab that before it gets big. So I think that, you know, people understand now that that's where everything, you know, what we're going to be talking about next year, you can see it now at those booths, you know.
I was just going to mention, and maybe you have an opinion about this, Nels. At the rant session that Lee participated in, you know, one of the things that sort of came out of that, it seemed to me, was a sense that we need to pay attention to these indie games because if we don't, they're going to kick our ass. That was Clint Hawking's little speech. You know, he was deadly serious too. He wasn't messing around. He was like, if we don't pay attention to what they're doing, they're going to eat our lunch. And he said it in a way that suggested to me that, you know, it was a bit of a clarion call, you know.
It's quite true. I think the strength of indie is really the only thing that's going to shake up some of the status quo complacency of the way that we're traditionally used to seeing things done.
Yeah. Do you have a sense, Nels, that indie games are having an impact on the way that the more mainstream developers are working?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. I mean, you know, as Hothead is both a big supporter of indie development, we have the Greenhouse platform and all of that, and, you know, I'm super, super happy to be working in an independent studio. There are some challenges, of course, like indie guys can come up with some really, really awesome ideas, but at the end of the day, they still have to be able to sell those to people so they don't lose their jobs.
And right.
I think figuring out the sort of the business model of the indie space is a challenge. But in terms of the innovation and the things that independent developers bring to the table, absolutely. I mean, that's going to be increasingly valuable. And, you know, it always takes a while for these things to kind of trickle down into the more traditional game developers. So in 2 or 3 years, hopefully things will be a lot more, there'll be a lot more reflections of the way indie people.
Yeah.
Actually sort of fascinating. I fantasize that there'll be like a sort of a business impact, because what we were beginning to see before the recession was just, and I think probably will continue to see enforced by the recession, was just massive mass consolidation in the business, like everybody becoming incorporated into some big publisher or other, which of course, you know, is a model that has its advantages, but, you know, it's also known to sort of restrain innovation in a lot of ways. But when we're looking at, you know, the role that individual spirit and talent is playing, when how successful some world of Goo can be, that's sort of, I don't know, I sort of fantasize that that'll encourage a return to the studio model, the individual stable, and less this sort of mass consolidation thing that we were starting to see. I hope that maybe at least just be the chink in the gears that sort of stops that machine from going.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know I'm a little sentimental about this stuff, but in that area on the show floor, I saw there was a particular game for the iPhone called Reuben and Lullaby. And it's by a designer named Eric Lawyer, and I got to know him just a little bit before the conference, and then got to know him a bit more during the conference. What I loved about that was, you know, here's a guy, I think this is like his first game, certainly his first game on the iPhone, and it had this beautiful kind of feeling if you would sort of stand nearby and listen to people stop at his little booth and talk to him. Because ultimately what he had to do as a designer of that game was like over and over and over explain what he was doing with it and like articulate like what his objectives were and where he intends to take that next. And beyond just like how many sales was he able to generate or interest in the game, it seemed to me that that environment for like a young designer having to talk to a lot of other people, many of them designers, about that game and talk about it in detail must be like a really developmentally really cool thing for him to have done.
I bet it was actually probably hard because, you know, I'm saying that it's such a good thing that, you know, there's a low barrier to entry on the iPhone and that it's so encouraging and really energizing that section of the indie space and just bringing so many new ideas to the table. But there's also the sort of downside to that and that there's basically a rush for it and people with good ideas have to try that much harder to get seen and get heard. And anybody who has an iPhone and uses the App Store knows it's sort of, you know, you're just confronted with this massive list of stuff and you have no idea what's good and what's not unless you've sort of heard about it or read about it. So there's a big, you know, there's a big like elbow throwing, I think, and a lot of challenge for people to find ways to kind of to make something surface. And you would argue that it's probably, if you have something like Reuben and Lullaby, which isn't all that easily comprehensible at first blush, it's probably a lot harder. So I actually don't envy him. Maybe it's cool for, you know, a couple of days, but I bet by the end of GDC, he was pretty tired.
Oh, he was shell-shocked. I mean, you should have seen him.
We should probably discuss the game for people who don't know what it is real briefly. It's a conversation between two people sitting on a park bench, very beautifully animated, and you do different things with the accelerometer, like tilt and shake, to sort of have them indicate their emotions toward each other, and you can decide whether they break up or make up, you know, based on whether they fight or laugh or things like that. That's basically the gist of it, yeah?
Yeah.
And then if you try to talk about that to someone, and if you're the designer of that game, and you try to say, well, I made this, people say, well, what? Why? You know, what is that? What can you win? You know, because it is, you know, it's not a quote-unquote game in the traditional sense, which although, of course, we're kind of very few things sort of adhere to the traditional sense anymore. But yeah, I don't envy him the challenge of trying to help people understand why that's interesting, important, or worthy of purchase.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, David, what about you? This was your first GDC as well, I think?
Yes, that's right.
So what did you find yourself thinking about afterwards or what made an impact on you?
Well, what I was surprised, so I'm an outsider. I blog about games, but I work as a programmer and a manager on a non-game related project on a video server. And what I was surprised was how much of what I saw, you know, was linked to my, you know, my other interests, my professional interests, and even my non-game personal interests. In particular, I saw this theme of sort of synchronization, team synchronization, showing up over and over and over again in half the talks I went to. So, obviously, this is important for video games because you want to have a game with a unified vision and how. But if there's dozens or even hundreds of people working on a game, that's really hard to do. And so some people talked about that. So, for example, in the Level 5 talk, they said, well, when they're starting a game, they actually start with a marketing message right at the beginning of the game. And first, my reaction to that was really negative because, you know, who wants the design of a game to be driven by marketing? But actually what they were doing was they were distilling the essence of what made this particular game special, and they were thinking about that right at the start. So, and then once they had that essence distilled down, then they could use that, of course, to communicate to the outside world, but then also the team itself could use that when working on the game so that they could make sure that they all agreed what was important about the game.
Sure, establishing a lexicon early on so that they can ensure it's consistent from pipeline to development to when they actually sell it so that there's a single through line from process to sales, which I think is kind of important.
Yeah, and Harmonix, you know, Level 5 had three sort of catchphrases they had about each game. Harmonix, they just said, you know, each game has one big question, and so whenever you're working on anything on the original Guitar Hero, you're just supposed to ask, does it rock? And if the answer was yes, then what you're working on was a good thing to be doing. If the answer was no, then it was a bad thing to be doing. So just, you know, one question. And so that's sort of the global aspect of team synchronization. But then there's also this micro aspect where, you know, we've all got the same big picture, but then there's the question is what everybody is working on, you know, right now well aligned? Are you doing something, or maybe you're doing something that fits with a big picture, but really isn't the best use of the time right now. It's kind of wasteful. And so this came up, for example, in the Iwata keynote. He was showing how at the beginning of working on projects, Miyamoto would do these very focused prototypes that were designed to answer one simple question, and you weren't supposed to put anything into those prototypes that wasn't helpful in designing those questions. So he showed this example of a prototype that was supposed to figure out if the motion controls for Wii Sports Boxing works. And so there were just two fighters, each of which consisted of four cubes. And so you could see the hands moving and the head bobbing, but you know, things like eyes or I mean, it's hard to imagine something that has less graphical finesse than the actual released Wii Sports product. But this prototype is that. And the point is, this is a focusing mechanism. So it just by stripping out all the other aspects of the graphics, you're really focusing. You don't get distracted on how something looks. It's just they wanted to answer how a specific mechanic plays. And you saw this in the BioWare talk, the iterative level design in BioWare. Each level goes through five or six stages, and at each stage in the level design, they have very specific questions that you're supposed to answer, and you're not allowed to do any work that's not related to those questions to answering those. So, you know, if you're on the early stage, you're just, you know, trying to get a feel for the gross shape of things and the gross plot of things. So the details of the wording and movement and cutscenes just isn't there. You're not supposed to be thinking about that. You're supposed to be thinking about the whole arc of the level, for example. Whereas when you're on one of the later stages, polishing stages, then you should be honing in on, you know, details of the voice acting and dialogue and things like that.
In terms of the actual, you know, in the trenches, like how to make games, not how to create or design, but how to make them, that talk from BioWare, I actually chatted with the guy who gave it earlier in the day. It was really, really good, just in terms of this is how, once you know what you want to make, here's how we make it. And, you know, they have these massive, massively scoped games. And just sort of seeing how they handle that complexity and how they do it was really, really interesting.
David, you mentioned that you come to it from another kind of programming and focused on something that's not necessarily video games. But do you find yourself drawn to this industry? I presume your attendance suggests that you're, you know, there's something exciting about it for you beyond just your interest in games.
Sure. There's no question about that. I really enjoyed the three days I spent at the conference listening to people, talking to people, and thinking about games. In terms of the idea of actually working in the games industry, there's some questions I have. I happen to actually, you know, rather enjoy spending time with my family, for example, and hearing the word crunch show up about, you know, once every 10 minutes over the course of the conference.
I hope you like pizza every day in the office cafeteria.
Yeah. Which was actually one of the interesting things about the BioWare talk, because what they were talking about was their level design process for Mass Effect 2. So this was a new process that they're using, and Mass Effect 1 was full of, you know, people spending long nights, and even so, there was a finished product where, we all know about the elevators in Mass Effect 1, and one key level was only about a third the size that it should have been. And they're saying that so far in Mass Effect 2, it's not done yet, but they haven't been having to ask people to work overtime almost at all, which is really impressive.
Yeah, that is.
But it is interesting that a lot of your thinking about whether or not you'd want to make that leap. And by the way, I don't mean to presume that you are or you aren't. I just was curious about, you know, kind of what you took away from it. But that you're that a lot of it has to do with just personal kind of work environment.
The quality of life issues.
Yeah, yeah, clearly.
And I actually think that, I mean, the game industry has definitely had a problem with quality of life issues in the past, for sure. And then I think as in any industry, a poor economy can sort of, you know, the game industry, you know, after some scandals had started to make a lot of serious strides in improving quality of life conditions. But, you know, now my concern is that now that we've got a recession and there's so many layoffs and so many people are just happy to have jobs, you know, are we going to lose some of our progress in that arena?
Yeah. It's the problem of an industry that you know, 22-year-old males fresh out of college very much want to work in, is that right. they'll put up
they'll
with things
anything.
That
yeah, well, I know maybe you have a different take on this, Nels, but I talked to Manveer Hare yesterday while I was talking to NGuy in that segment, and this actually didn't make the podcast because it was chatting before I was actually recording the podcast, but he mentioned that this whole idea that developers are going to eliminate crunch time. I mean, he just laughs at that idea. I mean, he just thinks that you can't eliminate it, and from his perspective, and that in his view, the companies that have tried have largely failed. And the economy that Lee is just as Lee described it is only going to make it worse. That it's just inherent into the process of making games.
Yeah. So I also come to this as a programming manager, and I pretty much refuse to ask people to work, you know, overtime unless there's a very focused short-term reason to do it. So if we've got an important customer demo, you know, in 2 weeks where coming in on the weekends will make a difference, then of course I'll ask people to do it. But if it's just kind of general panic that things aren't going well, and there's a few reasons for this. One is that I think just asking people to work more is it's the easiest solution to anything, or sort of pseudo solution to anything, and it kind of cuts off your creativity in terms of what should we really be spending time on. It gets you focused on, we'll just do what we're doing now and do more of it, instead of maybe some of the things we're doing now aren't actually the right things to be doing. But then the other reason, though, is when programming and other aspects of game design, it's an intense, creative, intellectual activity, and you can do that a lot better if your brain is fresh. And so the last thing I want is for people who've, you know, already worked 60 hours a week to be sitting at a keyboard inserting new software defects, writing bugs in the code. I mean, that's, or
it's counteractive after a point.
Right. Yeah, no, and it's, you know, sometimes there's direct bugs, and sometimes, you know, you just don't do things as well as you could, and it slows you down a month down the road where your code is harder to modify than it would have been because you weren't fresh enough to, you know, to simplify it and make it easy to work with.
I'm kind of as a writer, I'm kind of an insane workaholic too, and Simon like won't let me because he knows that I'm absolutely no good and useless after a point if I overdo it.
That's interesting. Yeah, well, so you sound like an enlightened producer, David. I mean, you seem like you have a sense of this that has come from your own experience working with people. But I mean, I'm curious from your perspective, Nels, is that common in your experience? Do you find
it's not as common as it should be? Like, it varies tremendously at the organization you're at. Like, I've heard horror stories from some of the people who worked here in town just about, you know, 6-8 months of crunch. And there's like real empirical backed up, basically irrefutable science that says you've got about 1 to 2 weeks of crunch time before you're at a net loss, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you can go for about a week or two, any longer than that, and you're actually behind where you would have been had you not been crunching for all the reasons that David listed. And I think, like, it's so variable on the studio. I'm one of the youngest people at Hothead. Like, almost everybody else there has families. So they just don't believe that crunch is viable, and they find ways to solve those problems. But when other places aren't like that, like when you have a stable of a bunch of people who just came out of university, then you just sort of, you know, you can run them through the grinder. And it takes a terrible toll on the industry at large, because those people get burned out and then bail. And then, you know, we have this tiny fractional amount of people who have actually been in the industry for a decade.
And turnover is super, super high.
Yeah, it's awful. and this is perhaps another strength of independent developers, where the more distance you have between the people who have to crunch and the people who order the crunch, the easier it is to do it. So maybe someplace like Raven.
It happens more at the bigger places, yeah.
Yeah, because it's easy for, you know, the super creative director who doesn't ever see any of these people ever to say, yeah, you guys got to come in for the next 6 weekends. But
right,
when
it's
you know,
easy for like the central design team at like an Activision or an EA to assign the studio to do this or that when they only see them at the milestones and know that they're not making them, you know?
Yeah.
Right. They don't understand what the problems are. It's definitely there's a bit of self-fulfilling prophecy in, you know, there's just inertia in larger organizations where they think, oh, you have to crunch to make video games. So then, you know, they don't try to find ways to solve the problems that are causing that crunch, and it just, you know, it's just becomes cyclical.
And isn't there, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't there an expectation like that it's sort of a career like teaching as well, and that you have during your season or during your project a number of intense hours, but then once you ship you get, you know, a month or 2 months off?
Yeah, again, that does depend on the studio. I know some people that were pushing pretty hard for a
they crunch and then they put right on the next thing. And
yeah, well, it depends. Like some folks, I know some people here were working on a pretty high profile Sony title, and they just like a death march. But then it was basically like 2 months of, you know, do whatever you want. You guys are basically paid to go to Germany for 2 months or whatever you want to do. I'm like, well, that's all right. I don't want to do that personally. You know, I don't want to keep teacher's hours.
Yeah, that's the flip side of crunch, even, you know, on a local level. I mean, I'd like to be working 40 hours a week, but I'd like to be working pretty hard during those 40 hours a week and thinking really well. And so this idea of amortizing it over.
Yeah, totally.
It's funny, it came up in the Lionhead talk, one of them I went to, that the issue of crunch coming to an end and then having time off has been really affected by the emergence of all this DLC. So you finish the game, but then bing, you got to start moving on the next content that you're going to release. And if it's
that's truer at big publishers too, where they have planned their DLC out to 2012. Activision, Take-Two, EA, you know, if they're going to release a game that has DLC as a component, and they've told their investors that they're going to have a certain revenue stream from DLC, you know, the studio, the developers don't really have a choice. They've got to get on that and do it when it's, you know, do it at the appointed time. They can't delay it because then the company has to announce it and stock's going to suffer. So
yeah. And the more you talk about it like that, and the more you sort of, you know, describe those conditions, it sounds more and more like a factory.
Yeah, it's tough.
Just another perk of being indie.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Or being a professor.
Yeah.
Or that. Paid 3 months of summer.
Yeah, well, we're working during those months, let me tell you.
Yeah,
being a wealthy game journalist.
That's right. Well, this has been a terrific conversation. I really appreciate your time, all three of you, and in particular, you know, it was kind of fun for me to hear how three people who approached GDC really from in a way from different walks of life got different things out of it. But also, I find it fascinating that we all talk to each other. I mean, we can meet each other at dinner and we can all converse afterwards. And I've written about this, but that seems
to be because of you, Michael. You're really, I think, the great unifier. Honestly, you're like the community leader now.
But these people, I mean, that these connections do happen in other fora. You know, that it seems to me that one of the things that I find most interesting about either it's the GDC or the way that the community works is that these odd connections continue to happen among people, and that people seem to find them useful still. That we're still not all buried in our own turf.
No, I think one thing that you can take away from GDC is the attitude from everyone, no matter what they're there for and why. You know, that I think everybody's really open minded and wants to learn. So I think that sort of drives a lot of the, you know, interesting partnerships that you're seeing.
Yeah, and just in general, you know, one of the characteristic things about people who work in the game space, for all its downsides, we're all incredibly lucky that we get to do something that's so interesting, that's so engaging, that people, lots of people, really, really care about. And I think that we're a far more passionate bunch than a lot of other folks. And we're just, you know, elated to chat with other people about all these interesting facets of how games are made and the cultural implications and all this stuff. And that's one of, like, the things I enjoy the most about being in this space, is that it's just so, you know, engaging.
Yeah. I'm talking to a friend. I have a friend who's actually crunching really bad right now. And I say, God, you know, that sounds so brutal. Why do you even do it? Because I love what I do. And I wake up every morning and I'm really happy to be here.
Well, I want to thank you, David Carlton, Lee Alexander, and Nels Anderson, all three of you, for speaking with me and also for meeting up at GDC. And I hope we can do it again next year.
Absolutely.
Same. So do I.
Definitely.
All right. Take care. Happy gaming. And I hope we can speak again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks.
Take care.
Just a quick note before this last segment. I have to apologize to Ben Fritz for the audio quality of my conversation with him in this segment. It's my fault for not being more careful about checking the sound quality of our connection. I had him on a landline via Skype, and you'll notice that the quality of that connection isn't as good as it is with the other two guests. And again, I apologize for that. As you'll discover, you can easily understand Ben and, you know, everything he has to say, but there is an artifact that sort of creeps in, and I wish I could have gotten rid of it. I did my best. But I hope you'll hang in there and listen despite that degraded sound quality. Everything he has to say is, I think, well worth hearing. So, again, apologies, and especially to you, Ben. I hope I'll do better next time. I am very happy to welcome three more guests to our post-GDC Gamers Confab collection of segments. This particular segment, I'm happy to introduce Mr. Ben Fritz, author of the Cutscene blog. He reports on the business of video games, video game culture. He also specializes in exclusive screenshots.
it's my new goal in life.
Welcome, Ben. You are a new member of the Gamers Confab, and it's really a thrill to have you on.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I hope you'll treat me gently.
We'll do our best. My second guest, actually sort of his first time in the Gamers Confab, although we've tried to have him on a couple times before, and I'm really glad that we were able to make it work this time. Mr. Duncan Fife, author of the hit Self-Destruct blog, also a regular columnist on Gamma Sutra. And Duncan, it's a great pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks, Michael. It's nice to be here.
Welcome, welcome. And finally, I have with me Mr. Wes Ertelak, known perhaps better to some of you as Iroquois Plissken, author of the Versus Clue Clue Land blog. And Wes, it's great to talk to you again.
Hey, it's good to talk to you too, Michael.
Well, I asked everyone to think about their experiences at GDC, and in particular to focus on maybe a session or a conversation that you might have had with someone on the side or at a dinner or wherever, but something that made a difference for you or that left a kind of a lasting impression on you from GDC. And why don't we start with Ben, and we can just kind of go around the horn.
Sure. Well, what I really found most interesting from the different sessions I went to was seeing some really different approaches to how you start the game, how you kind of start designing a game, and some people even seeming to disagree with each other. Not just, well, here's a different approach, but like, my way is right. I got that starting with, there was a Ubisoft event where they had several developers talking to the press on the first Monday, and I saw both Ben DeMattis, the producer of Prince of Persia, and of course Clint Hocking of Far Cry 2, both seem very insistent that you have to start with the mechanics and get the mechanics to work before you start thinking about story and character. And then, amusingly, later in the week, I was talking to Ray Muska and Greg Zeschuk, I'm probably saying their names wrong, the guys who are in BioWare, talking about their approach in starting Dragon Age. And they have the exact opposite approach. And they very strongly believe you're building out a world, you start building out the world and the characters and the storyline, and then you go from there. Huh. And then, thirdly, I went to the speech, I should say, of Keita Takahashi. He was talking about Nobi Nobi Boy. And he, you know, has his own insane approach to making games, which very much starts with just fun. There's no other way to say it besides his fun, kind of crazy ideas about how the world could be better through games. And he doesn't seem to think about whether it'll work or whether it makes sense. He just has these great ideas that he somehow is going to turn into a game. And they all not only have these very different approaches, but I think interestingly seem to very firmly say, you know, this is what we should see more of in gaming. The problem with games is that there isn't enough of the way I go about things. And they weren't mean, certainly, or they weren't attacking other people, but they were very insistent, I would say. Hmm. And it's kind of interesting both to see those different approaches and also to see that people believe strongly that their way is best.
Did you find yourself more convinced by one sort of way of going about it than the other, just from a point of view of a person listening kind of objectively to all of them?
I have to say, honestly, the way what I came out of believing was that they're all good approaches, and that video games should have room for all of them. You know, there's some games where I love, like, seeing more story, and even if the mechanics don't work perfectly, that's okay. And there's some games where the story comes second, and there's some games where it doesn't make any sense, but it's crazy fun. And, you know, I love Katamari. And so I came out of it thinking there should be room for it all. And I was more kind of intrigued that the developers didn't seem to quite agree that there should be equal room for all of them in the world of gaming.
Yeah. I know, Wes, you've written about this recently.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, is there a difference? And I mean, without overgeneralizing, which may be impossible, but is there a difference in your view, and Ben, you as well, between what you might call the Japanese developer approach to designing games and a Western approach?
Yeah, well, I mean, I tend to notice that the Japanese designers, like, they tend to, when they talk about the creative process, be like, just like a lot more gnomic, right? Like, they don't start out by, like, they tend to be very inarticulate about, like, where inspiration comes from, right? Like, you were talking on your blog, right, about the talk given by Suda51 in Ueda, and when it came to, like, explaining how they started out, it tended to be a lot more of these weird, idiosyncratic sort of visions of a world or sort of bizarre ideas they had, and then they go out in order to, like, realize that and build, like, a game around these weird visions, right, where a lot of the Western designers I talk to tend to think of starting with mechanics, right? There's a certain mechanic, a certain way of set of gameplay ideas that they're, like, think are fun, and then they build the world around that, and they tend to look at all the you know, what we might think of, like, the creative elements, like the world and the characters and stuff, as sort of things you just build around the doing of fun things with your hands, right? And I thought that was really interesting. I thought it was one of the things I noticed a lot about, you know, the different way that people, you know, obviously get into generalities, right? But the way the Japanese versus the way that American designers, like, the Ubisoft description is something I saw from a whole bunch of designers, right? Where they just sort of started with mechanics and then thought of everything else as sort of building off of that. So I thought it was interesting.
Do journalists attend sessions at conferences as journalists, if you know what I mean, like, are looking for stories which might lead you to think about, you know, what's being announced or what's going to come, or, you know, breaking things? Or do you go led by your nose in a way, sort of your own curiosity of, I mean, you go to a game design session, you may not be able to come out of that with, like, a scoop.
Yeah. I mean, my approach is, you know, if I'm actually going to a panel, I'm not looking for a scoop because I think it's unlikely I'm going to get one. You know, that's, like, very inefficient way to try to find a scoop is to go sit in panels and hope somebody says something they're not supposed to, basically. So, it happens, you know, so you could keep your ears open for it, but it's more, I think it's at GDC, my approach was I went to the extent I had time for panels, I went just trying to learn and, like, feel like I had better knowledge of the creative process in the industry to help with my reporting. But at GDC, there were a lot of private press events and meetings and briefings, and you can go there to get news, you know, in the sense of getting a first look at games or getting interviews that you might not usually get.
Yeah.
So that's more available for journalists at GDC if you actually want news.
How do you divide your time as a journalist at an event like this? Do you, I know there are all these events that occur sort of in and around the sessions that aren't official events or that you're supposed to meet somebody at a certain hotel or in a certain suite or something. How much of your time is spent at GDC doing those kinds of things as opposed to sort of official GDC sessions?
I'd say, unfortunately, it was the vast majority for me. And I next year I'm going to try to cut down, because what happens is, in the month or so leading up to GDC, you get, as a journalist, you get lots of interviews for, hey, come interview this person, or, hey, come to this exclusive panel or exclusive press briefing we're having. And I kind of, you know, said yes to any of them that sounded interesting. And then I started looking at the panels, and I was like, geez, I'm barely going to get to go to any panels. I booked myself so thick. So I tried to cut back on them somewhat. But it definitely, for me, was take advantage of these exclusive interviews or first looks at games I really want to see, and then try to build my panel schedule around it. But yeah. I think I lean too heavily in that direction.
Hey, Ben, I had a question. Like, after the GDC this year, I've seen, like, a couple articles on the blogs, which kind of say things to the sense that, like, the GDC, the sort of the strategy for the news coverage for the GDC right now is broken. That, like, if the GDC is just being what it's supposed to be, like, nothing newsworthy should be transpiring there.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And that, like, over the last couple of years, they've kind of become, like, dragged into, like, playing this surrogate role for E3 and being this place where people announce games and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Like, one of the things that people have been saying is that, like, you know, nothing really newsworthy happened this year, and like that's okay. That's a sign that the conference is being the kind of conference it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think a lot of people in the enthusiast press, especially, obviously, they want announcements or first looks or first screenshots, you know, so that because that's what gets that's the easy way to get page views. Is as readers of my blog know, I learned this week with my Saw story. you know, that's what they're hoping for. And last year there was more of it. Last year they announced Gears 2, you know, and Cliffy B came out and made it with a chainsaw and made an ass out of himself, you know, and I'm sure that got a ton of attention on the web. So that's what they're hoping for. But, you know, there wasn't that much of it this year, and that's not that isn't what GDC is supposed to be. And I think especially, you know, for the last 2 years, E3 has kind of not been sure what it is and been confused, and so GDC started taking some of those big announcements, you know. But this year, you know, everybody wants E3 to be back to its glory. So I think they're trying to hold, quote-unquote, hold the news or time news for that, which meant there was less of it at GDC. It probably meant some of the enthusiast press was more frustrated.
Yeah.
Mm.
Do you find that designers enjoy talking to you about their work? And I mean, I presume that since you go to these sessions, you have a natural curiosity about what they do. But, you know, you probably talk to a lot of publicists or a lot of sort of official PR people. Are your conversations with designers different?
They definitely are, you know, especially if it's a more casual atmosphere and there's off message, you know, because you can, if it's a very programmed interview that's been prepared by publicists and everything, then usually they are, unless they're Peter Molyneux, basically, they are on message and they've been told by the publicist what to say, and they say it, you know, and it's very difficult to get anything that, in my opinion, is interesting out of them. You know, in GDC, there's a lot of opportunities for more casual interactions or more, you know, things that are unexpected. And then, you know, they just talk like normal people. And sometimes, you know, as you guys discovered, you know, at panels and whatever, sometimes they sound confused and sometimes they have something really unique to say. But it's more like talking just to a, you know, to a fellow human being and not to a PR program robot. So it's very welcome for me.
I suppose you may get slightly jaded over time as a journalist about news and official releases and stuff. But is there a designer that you particularly sort of gear up for, enjoy talking to, especially because he or she might, you know, tend to be a little bit looser, a little bit more non-on message?
I always enjoy, honestly, talking to Peter Molyneux, and not for the reasons I think some journalists do, because he'll say outrageous things sometimes, you know, with some people. But I also, you know, a big admirer of his games, and I really like he's very frank about looking at back and what worked and what didn't work, and he's very honest about that. And a lot of designers, both for PR reasons, but also just for normal human ego reasons, I think have a tough time with that. He doesn't, which I really appreciate. And I always like talking to him for that reason.
Yeah. Well, Duncan, let's shift over to you. You sort of had a little Idle Thumbs reunion at GDC, and you guys published a special newspaper, and you guys were very busy in addition to sort of the other stuff you would have done. So I'm curious to hear about your experience.
Okay. Well, when you asked us to think about what we had learned from GDC for this podcast, I looked back through the notebook that I had kept to try and remember what I had actually learned. And most of the notes that I took for the sessions, I wrote the name of the speaker and then the title of the session, and then the rest of the page is blank. so I guess you could argue that what I learned at GDC was actually nothing. But then I thought about why I was barely taking any notes. And this was my second GDC. I went last year also, and last year I wrote down pretty much everything. And I think I was really excited by that GDC, I'm sure entirely because it was my first one, and everything was incredibly novel to me, and I became really enthusiastic about the industry. And Michael, I know you were there last year also. It's a pretty amazing thing if you've never been there before. It's like the entire industry relocates to the Moscone Center. And if you haven't had much interaction with the industry before that, it's kind of mind-blowing. Yeah. So that year was amazing. And I guess this year, partially, as you said, Michael, because we were doing this newspaper thing, which kind of distracted me from the conference proper. But I was kind of surprised by how little enthusiasm I had for this GDC comparatively. And it's not because the sessions were less interesting or anything, but I think since I'd been there before and I wasn't as naive about it, possibly, I sort of discovered that a lot of the sessions were not very relevant to me personally. And that's obvious, I guess, because I'm press. Well, I had a press pass, although I'm not press in any real sense of the word. And even this, you know, all the stuff that's geared toward, that's increasingly geared more towards press, like the Modern Warfare 2 trailer and the Mass Effect 2 footage and stuff, that's not, you know, relevant to me either, because I'm not, that's not my job. So yeah, I was just wondering why I was less excited about it this year, and why I felt, the reason why I didn't take any notes really, is because I sort of felt that there wasn't anything there that I did need to learn, and the sessions had no practical value to me for the most part. It was like, if I go to the session about puzzle design by Randy Smith, it's how am I going to apply this to my job? There's no way I can possibly do that. And I was surprised, I think, by just how much the actual sessions became like a backdrop for me. And the conference, while it's a good show, is only really relevant to me as a pretext for meeting and hanging out with the people who do work in this industry. We had our Idle Thumbs reunion, like you said, and that was a lot of fun. And then the conference is extremely valuable to me as an excuse for that. But I kind of found, I kind of learned this year that that's the only value it really has to me personally. So in answer to your question, your original question, what did I learn at GDC? I think I learned about the true spirit of GDC, and also that the true spirit of GDC is not very relevant to me anymore.
Last year, I recall you went to, and you may have this year as well, I can't recall, went to the first couple of days of GDC where the crowds are smaller, they're more intensive kinds of tutorials or seminar sessions. Do those differ in your view from the kind of the rest of the conference events after Tuesday? I asked Manvir this question earlier, and he talked about that a little bit, but he's a designer, and I thought your perspective might be different.
Yeah, well, last year I went to the game design workshop, and this year I skipped on that because I'd done it before, and I went to a couple of the indie game summit sessions, and those sessions are not very different, I think, from, they might be different in character or in style from the sessions that follow from Wednesday onwards, but the game design workshop is very different. It's spread out. It's mostly because it's spread out over 2 days, and you get to, you're obviously a lot more involved in the process, and that was really fun. That was one of the highlights of GDC last year, being involved in that stuff. But obviously that's different because it's a workshop and not a session. But aside from the workshops, I don't think there is much difference really between these sessions pre-Wednesday and post-Wednesday, other than attendance.
Right. So, I mean, for you then, help me if I'm not, sort of restating this correctly, that there's not necessarily a connection between you sort of enhancing your understanding of a certain kind of game design or a certain approach to game design and you writing about games from the critical perspective.
I'm not sure. I think some of the sessions are very interesting to discuss, and they can be thought provoking. Like Clint Hawking's talk was great, and Margaret Robertson was also good. But I kind of feel like there's no. It can be interesting in forming the basis of a discussion, but not extremely practical, or not practical in the same reason that it's practical for other people who attend. Because I was hanging out with a lot of designers who were scribbling notes furiously because they have to go back to their job the following week and kind of justify the trip to GDC and, go through all these ideas that may be relevant to their next game or not. And, yeah, I didn't get the same things from it that they did, obviously.
I had a question. Duncan, like when you, one thing I noticed that like is a lot of these panels are kind of like inside baseball, kind of like very nuts and bolts breaking downs of how people go about doing certain types of game design, right? Do you find that like in the past, like going to the GDC and hearing people talk about, you know, the way they go about doing video games in this way and being like really, really kind of super thorough, right? Do you find that that helps you when you go back to doing the type of, you know, like critical writing, or do you just think that like, it doesn't matter to the type of experience I'm having how, you know, they, you know, shaded this particular texture, right? Or like, you know, went about designing this particular puzzle. All that matters to me is like what it's like when I have it in my hands.
Yeah, well, I mean, for obvious reasons, I try and avoid the sessions where they talk about shading textures. but yeah, I mean, I tend to go to a lot of the broader design lectures because that is, you know, the most accessible stuff, probably. But I don't know how much that informs my opinion of game design so much. I tend not to engage in my writing with really high-level concepts. I don't know why that is necessarily, but it's just, I think it increasingly has less to do with how I think about games.
I do, because we mentioned it briefly, and I expect some people may not know what we were talking about. You and Chris Remo and Steve Gaynor, and I may have been other people involved that I was less familiar with, engaged in a certain kind of journalistic guerrilla tactics, getting a newspaper published and distributed on your own at GDC in a way that I would imagine has never been done before.
I don't know.
I'd be curious to hear you just mention what you guys were up to with that and how you, looking over your shoulder now, how all that went.
Yeah, well, I'll just try and briefly recap it. Basically, there was a site that I used to work for, write for Idle Thumbs, which kind of fell apart a few years ago and then was relaunched as a podcast by Chris Remo and some of the other guys originally involved in the site. And this year, they decided, just for fun, pretty much, that it would be a good idea to put out a newspaper. There really wasn't a lot of, I don't think there was a lot of discussions that went into it beyond that. And so they decided they would have it ready for GDC and pretty much just put it together with some new content and stuff that had been written on Steve Gaynor's blog and mine and Marek Bronstring's blog. And then we just kind of handed it out around GDC for free. And maybe that was a reason why the conference itself became less relevant to me, because I was so much more focused on doing this thing, to my surprise. But yeah, it was kind of an arbitrary exercise in a lot of ways, but a fun one.
Well, but I mean, and I know, I think Wes has seen it as well. I don't know, Ben, did you see the newspaper as well?
I did indeed.
Okay. I mean, it's worth mentioning because it actually has some really good stuff in it.
It's really good.
Some of it was clearly kind of a highlight reel of some things that you've written already on your blog and Steve as well, but not all of it. And in fact, I thought, maybe I'm wrong about this, but it seemed like you used some of that earlier material to kind of build a little bit of a foundation for some of the newer pieces that you put in there as well. And just as an example of kind of a collection of thoughtful writing about games, you know, fairly critically astute writing about games, I thought it was actually a pretty impressive little newspaper.
Yeah, well, thanks. I mean, I was not involved so much in the actual production of the newspaper, more the distribution of it. But yeah, I think the intent of those guys was definitely just not to make it a joke and have it, and it should have some redeeming value, I guess, rather than something you read and laugh at, maybe, and then toss away. One quick thing I would like to say about the newspaper is that on Friday after the conference ended, a couple of us were driving away, and I looked out my window and this was a couple of blocks away from the Moscone Center, and I saw a copy of the Idle Thumbs newspaper in the gutter, and then it kind of drifted away. That seemed appropriate. Oh, also, sorry, one thing I would like to add. I said that I didn't write any new content for the newspaper, but I did pitch the one piece of new content that I pitched, which was not used. I came up with a joke. I came up with a video game joke, and I would like to say it now, if that's okay.
Please
since
do.
Since never gotten
used, Michael.
This is a scoop.
It is a scoop. This is what you've been looking for, Ben.
You noticed that Ben was the first one to immediately call that a scoop.
Inclusive, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
What do you call a cocaine addict? A rail shooter.
Oh, God.
They didn't use that. I'm not sure why.
What?
Anyway, I'm done.
Well, let's shift it over to you, Wes, and you know, similar question. What did you walk away with GDC? This was your first time, right?
Yeah, this was my first time. The question is like, what did I learn at GDC? And Well, I mean, there were a lot of really good panels, but the panel that's kind of stuck with me actually is the Randy Smith panel that Duncan was just talking about puzzle design in games. And so what I learned from that panel is that a good video game should be like a good conversation, right? That was like my takeaway. And this is kind of like one of these things that it's kind of stuck with me. And even now I kind of think about it as I've been playing some games. But so anyhow, the talk is this guy named Randy Smith. He used to work at EA. He writes a column for Edge. And he designed some games like he designed a couple games in the Thief series and Dark Messiah and Might and Magic. And I really kind of love this talk. First off, because like I really love environmental puzzles. Like that style of gameplay really, really appeals to me. Like when I think of like my favorite games, like Half-Life 2 and Portal and Shadow of the Colossus and Zelda, like basically those are like as good as it gets for me, right? In terms of like video games, right? And those are all games that sort of focus around environmental puzzles. So I thought that was really cool. And the other thing is that like I'm really kind of fascinated with the way that games communicate their rules to their players. Like that's something that I write about a lot on my blog. And that was really interesting to me is the way that he gave this talk about thinking about puzzles as a way of communicating the way that the underlying systems work and how they go about designing it that way. So the conceit of the talk, right, was that he was thinking of like puzzle design in games as a type of UI problem, right? So UI is like that portion of software design where it's like this part of the software that the user interfaces with in order to use the underlying system that it's controlling, right? And so his idea was like thinking of user-centric design, right? So how do you design things in such a way? How do you design your puzzles so that it communicates to the player so that they understand how to use it? And as an example was, he talked about this book. I don't know if you guys have heard of it. Nels Anderson wrote about it on his blog a while back called Donald Norman. It's called The Design of Everyday Things.
Yeah, that book keeps coming up on my blog and comments and stuff. People keep referencing that book.
Yeah, it's a book about how ordinary objects like stovetops, the way that stovetops are laid out, the way that like door handles are designed, the way that like tea kettles are designed. But he talks about how one of the really interesting sort of lessons that Smith talked about is that like the way that user-centric design works is that like just the design of the object teaches you how to use it. So like, you know, like the way that a door handle is sort of mounted on a door tells you whether or not it's a push door or a pull door. And he had all sorts of like really illuminating examples to sort of talk about the way that like different objects use this and like this sort of like magical intuitivity that we sometimes think about, like when we're using a system and we just sort of like pick it up and we understand how it works. Right. About like all these little tricks that go into it. So he talks about like, you know, like visibility, the visual design of the object, this, you know, idea of like affordances. Right. Like if you look at the object, can you tell what it does? You know, if you look at like a lever, can you tell whether it pushes or pulls? When you look at a door, can you tell whether it pushes or pulls? This visual language and the way that like certain objects give you feedback about how they're used. But I mean, it was really cool. Like he sort of had this like extended riff on the second room of Portal. And the second room of Portal is like the easiest puzzle you've ever seen in the entire world, right? There's like a block in the corner and then there's a button. And what you need to do is walk over and grab the block and put it on the button and it opens a door. But he would show these screenshots and talk about the design and sort of like just walk you through all the sort of meticulous visual and sort of environmental details they had put in order to communicate to the player like the underlying rules by which the system worked, right? So it could communicate these things that you can't stand on the button and then run for the door, right? The door is going to close before you get there. So how do you communicate to that player? How do you communicate to the player like the relationship between the button in the middle of the floor and how it works and like the door? How do you understand that the button is something that responds to weight? So the cube will make the door work, but also the person standing on the so we kind of like walked through all these things. And one of the things that really kind of struck me that was sort of like the takeaway from the whole the whole presentation is that like when you interact with a puzzle and it's working correctly, what's really happening is that the puzzle is telling you, you know, giving you feedback about how it works as you go, right? The visual design and also as you use it, it's kind of communicating you information about how the underlying system works when it works really well, right? Like things happen that tell you whether or not you're on the right track in terms of something, and then there's feedback. And it made me really think that when I go back to what I really liked about those games is this sense that you're kind of like, as you're going through a puzzle, right? And as you're going through doing something, it's like you're having a conversation with a designer, right? There's a certain thought process that you're going through and you're trying stuff out and you're like, oh, does this work? And then the game's saying back to you, oh, no, 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 you're on the wrong track, you know, that kind of stuff. So, and that's something I tend to think about a lot about games, like how are they teaching things to you? And there's this sort of back and forth dialogue between you and the game about how things work. And it was all illustrated with all these like really great examples from like, you know, things he had made in the past. And he was very candid about showing like, you know, I made this game and like people got really hung up and couldn't figure out what the hell they were supposed to do. And like, this is why, because like, you know, the book wasn't at eye level and people were wandering around and couldn't find this stuff. So it was really, really interesting. And, you know, as I'm going back and I've been playing different games right now and I'm playing Resident Evil 5 right now. Has anyone played that game?
Yeah.
Resident
Evil 5.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and that is a game now that like I look at it and I have like this whole different viewpoint. I'm like, oh, this game is very badly designed, very very badly designed. Like, you know, like boss battles, right? In Resident Evil 5, like a boss battle is really, let's be honest, it's a type of puzzle, right? Mm-hmm. They're always one of these things where you're being called on to like use a novel skill set, right, and do something different from what you do normally. And the game's supposed to teach you like what you're supposed to do, but like so many of those parts in Resident Evil 5, you're like, you get in there and you're like, it just doesn't give you the feedback you're supposed to have in order to understand like what's going on, you know. Plus it has terrible puzzles. It's got those, remember that puzzle where you're like, you have a reflecting mirror and you need to reflect the mirror. Like, oh my God, every single Japanese game on earth has that exact same puzzle.
It's true.
Where you're turning reflecting mirrors in order to make like a path of light go a certain, you know, to a certain area. And I was like, oh, this is so uncreative and like unintuitively designed. So, yeah, but anyhow, that was the session that I liked the most. There were a lot of things that were like super interesting, but like that particular one, I really enjoyed.
Yeah, you know, a couple of things about that. One's very anecdotal, but there's a level designer. I probably shouldn't mention his name because I didn't ask him if I could tell this story. But he was at that session and he was telling me about it. And you know, he just basically came clean and said, "I wrote down to myself about halfway through that talk, it's time to go back to the drawing board on the game we're working on right now." Like,
really?
Yeah. Like it. They're at the stage of development of this game where, you know, they're laying things out. They're planning it. They haven't done a lot of building, but just it was sort of a little snapshot for me of how, in fact, GDC is what it claims to be sometimes, which is, you know, developers coming together and sort of sharing ideas and teaching each other things and having, you know, possibly a little light bulb moment as a designer where someone else says, hey, have you thought about this? And someone says, no, I haven't, which, you know, is interesting. But the other thing about this, and I'd be curious about your take on this, Wes, and Duncan, you were at the same session?
Yeah.
Okay. And Ben, did you happen to see this one as well?
No, unfortunately not.
Okay. I didn't either. That there is a certain kind of teaching that occurs in these sessions that you've got a person who's doing one of the hardest things you can do as a teacher, which is to deal with abstract concepts and then to illustrate them in ways that get people to understand what you're talking about. And the same person I was talking to about this particular session was telling me he was just amazed at what a good teacher Smith was and how he was able to kind of present this information so clearly. And he could have easily botched it. did you get a sense of that as well, Wes?
Oh yeah, it was really remarkable. In fact, I was surprised how many game designers were in fact good at explaining these kind of like very difficult, complicated concepts that went into their design. Like Hawking and Margaret Robertson, I thought were both also very good and sort of engaging speakers. But yeah, it was strange. It was really impressive how he managed to. You know, I think it's a combination of like, I don't know, everyone at GDC uses slides, like everyone uses PowerPoint. But some people are really just excellent at like using examples in order to illustrate the sort of concepts that they're talking about. Like a lot of the stuff that went on in the talk and, you know, talking about this book about, you know, the design of every object could have been like very high flown. But I don't know if it's just Randy Smith. He had a very, you know, a sort of gift for presenting these ideas and like very straightforward language, drawing on examples that really illustrated the sort of fundamental points that he was making really well. So yeah, I was, there were other people who were good at it too. And then there were some people who were like kind of inarticulate and you kind of had a hard time following it, but I was impressed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most of the people, like Clint Hawking and Randy Smith and Margaret Robertson have spoken at GDC before. So I imagine that they're a bit more practiced at this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I guess Randy Smith also has his Edge column, and so he might, I don't know, he's used to communicating his ideas to an unfamiliar audience, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good point. Ben, do you think are there sessions at GDC that should be happening that aren't? I guess GDC is in some ways not meant to serve us, maybe critics or journalists, but should it attempt to do that more or not?
I think a little bit of it wouldn't hurt. I think having a few that are like, college professors, how they always have like a physics for poets class, and the basics. I think given that there's a number of people at GDC who are not in fact game design professionals, I would think having a few panels oriented for those people would be not only good for us, but also maybe good for the industry to kind of help, those of us who are in it enough to care and to know the basics, but want to know more, to help us learn, even if it's a little bit below the level of the average GDC attendee who's in the industry. I would think that could be a super helpful thing, And then I would think a panel like that, we're learning some basics would help us get more out of the more advanced panels, essentially, So that strikes me as a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think GDC is already becoming more of a general industry convention rather than a specific developers thing. And I don't know, I wouldn't be surprised if it heads more in that direction in the coming years. I don't know if it's valuable. I don't know if it's worth turning GDC into that or just starting a new convention, which is a more general thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're going to go more in that direction. I think they are, but I guess I'm just sort of torn as to whether that's a good thing or not.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm going to answer again, but it occurs to me as I was thinking that sometimes they have those panels where they let developers speak back to critics or whatever, and usually they end up bitching and moaning, about the way reviews are done or scores or crap like that. But I wonder if it wouldn't be useful to say, here are things that you should know about how games are made that don't seem to be understood in your reviews that you get on our case about that, that would be really useful, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that would be really interesting. I actually went to one of the panels that I went to was a panel of former games journalists who had since moved over into development. And it was really interesting to hear them talk about, how did they view when they thought back on their times when they were journalists and there were people making critiques about games, did they say things all the time? I asked them, did they say things all the time that they regretted? Did they say things that seemed to them sort of like fundamentally out of touch with the way that, the technical possibilities of game development? And almost to a man, they said no. They said that, being a developer, they still thought that, if you understand how games are designed and you understand how to critique them, you're able to discriminate between the things that people are capable of doing and could have done better, right? And could have, done correctly, and those things that are technically infeasible. So I think that kind of thing would be interesting.
I found it interesting. One of the more popular sessions are these rants, and in the past they've had game developers do rants, and the rants are often about game scores and bad journalism and irresponsible journalism and stuff like that. And then this year it was game journalists got to have their rant, and it was basically bad journalism, bad writing, bad sales scores. It was the same targets from both the developers and the journalists. I found that fascinating.
Well, journalists are, the media loves nothing more than to criticize itself and talk about themselves, you can see that in any kind of media, right?
So, yeah.
Perhaps that's not too surprising, whereas maybe game developers in a better sense are a little bit more self-protective and want to keep their fights out of the public eye.
Yeah. So having attended your first GDC then, Wes, do you intend to go back next year, and do you intend to sort of alter your experience at all? I know for me, my first year, I was just kind of wide-eyed and really just kind of went wherever some people I knew were going. I didn't really choose my sessions very carefully. I probably went to the ones that seemed more high profile. And this year I kind of went off the beaten path and tried different things. I think I approached the whole thing differently. Would you go about your business next year any differently having done it one time?
I really had a great time, and half of it is just sort of meeting people that I had read the blog and had known, meeting you and Duncan and Ben. But the other half is that I think if I was doing it all over again, I think you kind of have to follow the people you know who are good at talking about their craft, right? Like, you know, having gone here once, I know that Clint Hawking and Margaret Robertson and Randy Smith give a good talk, and more than, you know, attempting to go see a talk by someone who had made a game that I was interested in or someone who is kind of high profile. Usually it seems that like the high profile people talking about their games are kind of duds. And people who sometimes who work on like more obscure games, but, you know, people like Randy Smith who are like just super articulate about talking about game design, like I would follow them around regardless of their topic, right? Like if Randy Smith's next, you know, talk was about like bidet design, I'd be like, oh, I'm going to go to Randy Smith's bidet design talk, you know, because that's the, you know, because he's someone who really understands how things are going. So,
yeah. I'd be curious about your takes on this, each of you. The two, you know, really large, high-profile Kojima and Iwata talks, which are held in the hall that holds the most people, were just, in my opinion, both duds. I mean, that they were really very uninteresting. I guess the Iwata talk maybe had a few details and a few announcements or whatever, but I was terribly disappointed by the Kojima talk. And I wondered if... Maybe your idea of those talks was different, but is it just the nature of that kind of talk that they're not going to be as interesting? They're going to be very generic and very sort of right down the middle, or is it possible for that to go another way?
I would say, in my experience, it's very difficult for it to go another way. Again, because of the PR element, frankly, because you know. I can't speak for Kojima, I wasn't there, but for Iwata and that kind of thing, usually, you know, I know for a fact that, like, that the people from Nintendo of America, for instance, were very heavily involved in planning that presentation with him and probably writing a lot of it, you know, and figuring out what kind of messages they wanted to communicate, you know, yeah. And when it's being used for, when it, in that high profile of speech, it's going to be used more for strategic purposes for the corporation, you know,
yeah.
Rather than for a creator to just share thoughts or express a vision or try to push an industry in a certain way. It's just the nature of something that's that high profile in, you know, in such a, in a world where everything gets covered and dissected, that it's very rare to have somebody who's willing to go out there and say what they're thinking and take a risk, you know?
Guys, you've been, sorry, Duncan.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, so you guys have been to GDCs in the past. Did these large sort of keynote style deals ever end up, you know, being really good or really insightful? Do people say things in them?
I don't know anyone who ever expected a keynote to be especially insightful. I think more people expect them to be full of big announcements, like Gears of War 2 being announced at the Microsoft
yeah,
keynote,
right. Yep.
Or as a place where they get free things, like Brain Age, or I guess JL had handed out in HDTV a while ago.
Yep.
So I don't know. I think this, you know, the spectacle is a large part of what makes those so interesting.
It's interesting to me though, because it is such. It is an event about game development. I realize that there are a lot of people like me there that aren't developers, but I mean, there's a huge number of people there. The majority, I would imagine, are very much in the industry working. And so you would think that these big keynote talks, the sort of the word would be out about them, you know, that they're, whatever, they're going to be boring. But they're packed. Like, you know, you have to stand in the back even to get in the door if you're 15 minutes late. Why do so many people go?
Because it's Hideo Kojima and people like that guy, or people don't like him and expect to be entertained by him nonetheless. I don't know.
Well, I guess we'll leave it there. I promised that I would try to keep these segments to a manageable length, since I'm kind of packaging them with other segments. And anything that that you wanted to mention that I neglected to ask you about, Ben, Duncan, or Wes?
Only I hope somebody knows, or hope somebody by the end of this podcast will mention that, you know, that Keita Takahashi wanted to give out a scarf made by his mother to people who played Nobi Nobi Boy, and that was one of his big regrets, was that he couldn't figure out how to do that.
That's too bad.
Yeah,
I did hear good things about that Nobi Nobi Boy talk. Several people told me they really enjoyed it.
It was, fascinating. It was, you know.
Yeah, what did you enjoy about it, Duncan?
Well, I guess this goes back to my ridiculous identity crisis that I mentioned earlier, but it was just a hugely entertaining session, and he's one of the most... no one else in the industry is like that guy, and Maybe he deserves his own keynote. I don't know. But the ideas that he has about game design and the social responsibility are just so unlike anything else that you're going to hear at GDC or in the industry in general. And he's sort of, I don't know, at turns just, I don't know, yeah, unintentionally hilarious and also heartfelt in a, I don't know, a very interesting way.
Yeah.
Then there's actually a small part of me that thinks it's all performance art and he's playing a big joke.
Yeah, I don't know how aware he is of how funny he actually is. I'm sure he is to an extent, but it's hard to tell what he's putting on and what he isn't.
Right. Yeah. I read the account. It was really kind of funny to me because I went to other panels and people were like very gung-ho about games. They're like, oh, games are great. And like we went to this game, me and Ben were at this games and social responsibility panel and people were really up on like, you know, the transformative power of games. And it seems like Takahashi was like, yeah, people play too many games like all the time. People really need to like do other things with their time. And like, that's why I made the game this way. It's like, it's not meant to take too much of your time. You're supposed to just futz with it for a while, and then like you really should go do other things. Like people play too many video games.
Well, Wes and I talked about this briefly. I think going from one session to another, there is a perception, and I think it's largely inaccurate from my very brief interactions with these people that certain developers like Yoida, for example, the Ico and Shadow of the Colossus guy, that there's like they're these sort of prima donnas that they just can't be bothered to actually discuss or dissect their work. It's all inspiration and it all comes down from the heavens and, you know, they can't possibly describe their work. And it really was not my experience that I did not see that happening. I saw designers like genuinely struggling to try to articulate a process that seems to come easier to Western designers, that there's a certain kind of division of labor or a certain way of approaching, you know, project management with game design that easily lends itself to discussing it, and that they don't approach it that way necessarily. And so it suddenly a person on a panel asks them a question and you can just see them sitting there trying to formulate an answer and kind of coming up empty. And it was fascinating for me to watch that happen.
Yeah, that's true. If they're a Hollywood director, you know they'd come up with some answer, even if it was a bullshit fake answer. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Come up with something.
Yeah, I mean, it was that kind of the courage of silence. You know, that Ueda in particular, you know, he was fine with just sort of sitting there and not saying anything. You know, and, you know, it's the kind of thing where you feel like, oh, there's a gap, I must speak. You know, fill the gap with sound. But he was just, you know, unable at times to really articulate anything, and so he didn't.
I think, by the way, I think one of the reasons is because game developers are often employees of the company, the publishers they work for. They don't have to worry about their image quite as much. Whereas if you're a director going from project to project, you want to sound like you're really smart, a film director, like you're really smart, really have a vision, so executives will be impressed by you and want to keep hiring you.
Yeah. It sounds like you're speaking from experience, Ben.
I know a few people in Hollywood. I've heard a bit of bullshitting in my.
Well, I want to thank all three of you, Wes Ertelak, Duncan Fife, and Ben Fritz, for joining me in this edition of the Gamers Confab. I really appreciate your time and your thoughtfulness. And I hope that, Duncan, I hope you decide to go back to GDC next year. So we can all
I didn't say out. I wouldn't go back. I would love to go back.
Okay. Well, thanks to all of you, and I hope that we can chat again soon.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, take care.
Bye.